Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we'll talk about how the lottery works, why it's so high, and who this affects. Next, thousands of migrants attempting to escape poverty and violence have made it into Mexico and are heading north towards the United States. As this human drama plays out, Donald Trump and the Republican Party are seeking to exploit the situation for their electoral advantage. Then, the U.S. Cyber Command announced that it is targeting Russian operatives, claiming this is an effort to deter them from influencing the U.S. midterm elections. The cyber cold war is heating up. And then, Chinese President Xi Jinping yesterday opened the world's largest bridge 9 years after construction began. The 34-mile-long span will connect Hong Kong to Macau to the Chinese mainland and is supposed to enhance economic growth in the region, but the corporate media in the West is treating it like an act of aggression. And finally, we're 14 short days away from midterm elections, and in many states, early voting is already breaking records. Most of those states are in the South, where early voting is up between 100 and 1,000%. And according to the Cook Political Report, it's Republicans who seem to be flocking to the polls. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Americans have caught lottery fever. The multi-state Mega Millions lottery jackpot stands at more than $1.6 billion. But what really happens to the money that the states keep? Is it put to good use? And isn't the lottery just really kind of a tax? We're joined from New York by Richard Wolf. He's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolf's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I want to call this segment A Socialist View of Mega Millions. Go ahead, Richard Wolf. Let's talk about the economics of this thing.
Okay, well, there are several ways to go at this, and they all come to a conclusion that there's something downright perverse about all of this. And whatever romance or drama you find in it, you ought to balance that for an awareness, at least, of the costs of all of this. Let's start with the notion that you have already in your mind, and quite correctly so, that this is a tax. If you do a map of any major American city, and I've done this myself a couple times, and you do a map and you superimpose onto that map a transparency that indicates where lottery tickets are sold, and then you do another transparency that indicates rich and poor neighborhoods in that city, you very quickly notice something. Basically, the poorer the neighborhood, the more lottery tickets are sold. In other words, this is something that appeals to and draws money out of the wallets of people in the middle and lower income groups in our society. The people who run governments in the 50 states figured that out long ago. They discovered that when you tax people, they get angry. But if you tell them, I'm going to take some money out of your pocket, but I'm going to give you a chance to become a millionaire, they part with their money and enjoy the process rather than get angry when you tax them. For wealthy people and corporations, this was nirvana. It was a way to shift the burden of funding government off of taxing corporations, off of taxing the rich, onto the mass of people, and not incur the mass of people's anger and resentment at this way of sucking money out of the people who can afford it least. Your odds of winning that big lottery now are less than 1 in 300 million. You are therefore paying money for something that isn't going to happen in 99.9999999% of the cases. It's simply a disguised form of taxation. And by the way, it has existed in European countries long before it was adopted here. And part of the reason it was adopted here was that the European counterparts explained that this is a substitute for taxing. You can tax the mass of people, and they'll line up to buy the ticket rather than grouse and grumble that you're doing it. But that's not all. Here's the two other parts of this that ought to make you stop and think. First, a good portion of the money is not used for government services. So it's not like a tax. At least that money is raised by the government and used to pay public services. But a good portion of this is given to an individual, the winner of the lottery, that one person out of millions who actually gets the big bundle of money. So the government doesn't have as much to use for providing services to us as it would have had if it taxed corporations and the rich for the full amount of the money they would have then gotten. But there's a third problem. Think of it this way. You're taking money from lots of people who buy $5, $10, $50, even $100 worth of lottery tickets. That's money they're not going to spend on food, clothing, shelter, and all the other things that provide jobs. We're taking that money away from millions of people, and we're giving it in a big fat pot to one person. And here's what we know in economics. That one person isn't going to be spending it all because you literally can't. A large portion of that money is going to be saved, not spent on food, clothing, and shelter that creates jobs. So this is a job-destroying reconcentration or redistribution of wealth, taking a little bit from many and making one person fantastically rich. This is not good for the overall functioning of the economy, just like using this money to give a big pot to that individual means the government doesn't have it. And finally, it's a fakery because it's really a tax on most of the people who can afford it least. And that ought to make people question before they fall into the romance of this sort of thing.
We marvel at the sizes of these jackpots too. But isn't it true that the reason we have such big jackpots is because these lotteries have been manipulated? They've added numbers, they've added balls to make for extra numbers. And where a jackpot used to be $10 million, $12 million, now there are hundreds of millions of dollars.
Or now it's $1.6 billion today.
$1.6 billion. But wasn't that the goal, to manipulate this thing so that it made it that much more difficult, where you're something like 1,000 times more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to win the lotto?
Yeah, I think it's like many of these things. After a while, at one level, it doesn't work anymore. You've gotten used to it. So how do you get people to part with their money? Having bought lottery tickets for a long time and gotten exactly nothing, and let's remember, that's what happens to the vast majority of people. They get nothing. So under those circumstances, they're going to lose interest. They're going to fade out. They're going to stop buying the lottery tickets. And so you have to do something to hype it. One of the things they did a while back was they started taking out paid advertisements. Let's be real clear. That means part of the money that you spend to buy a lottery ticket is not going to the government to do useful social services, and it's not even going to the winner of the lottery. It's going to pay for billboards on the highway and for ads in the newspaper to get you to buy the ticket. And when that wasn't enough, they raised the jackpot to be able to get those headlines that you're referring to now, $1.6 billion, because that will get people's attention. It's just an endless game of advertising hype to get you to part with your money when the chance of your winning is virtually zero. It's a little bit like throwing your money into the toilet and watching it flush down and getting some sort of thrill out of the process. But in terms of an investment and in terms of a prudent use of your income and your wealth, it's craziness.
Yeah, and it's done in small increments. You know, there's another part of it. That I'm glad you raised the individualistic element of this. Everybody parts with their money, which is a tax, basically a non-progressive tax, meaning not on the rich, not on the affluent who don't play these games. It's on the working class or the middle class and the poor. People are parting with their money. They do it every week. They do it multiple times in a given week. The dream, the prospect of finally escaping from being low income or being poor or just having a working class lifestyle and becoming ever richer. It also has impacted, I think, consciousness where, you know, historically workers thought banding together, working together, organizing together, struggling as a collective. What's good for one is good for, what's good for everyone is good for the person. In other words, social advancement comes through collective struggle, not through like this, just, I got lucky, I hit the jackpot, I had the golden pot at the end of the rainbow. Like, it does impact consciousness too. Go ahead. We have 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I think it's a great tragedy. For me, I see it slightly differently. I see a society that is condemning the vast majority of people to jobs and incomes that are insecure and insufficient, and almost as a torture to people who are not being given the income they deserve, the wages they deserve, the life they expected and studied hard to get. Instead, you dangle the dream in front of them, as if almost to reinforce the notion you're never going to escape from the position this society imposes on you unless you get one out of 300 million chance to be suddenly wealthy and free. It in a peculiar way, it underscores the injustice and inequality of the society by making escape so far out of reach. It has an ideological function in that way that's very serious and very much unwelcome in a society like ours.
That was the voice of Richard Wolff, who joined us from New York. He is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Thousands of migrant workers are attempting to escape poverty and violence and repression and oppression, and they have made it from Central America into Mexico and are heading north towards the United States. As this human drama plays out, Donald Trump and the Republican Party are seeking to exploit the situation for their own electoral advantage. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Eduardo Garcia. He is an activist and photojournalist born in Mexico City who coordinates Alliance for Global Justice, AFGJ, Prisons Imperialism's Project, and supports the solidarity work in Honduras. Eduardo Garcia, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eduardo, just talk as we begin your own connection to this movement, this caravan. Of course, it's not the only caravan. There have been periodic caravans of migrants coming north from Central America and from Mexico. But just talk about your own connection to this phenomena.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that question. Basically, I started getting related to these caravans back in 2011 when people from Central America, mostly all of them from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, organized the first migrant caravan. And at that moment, I was a human rights activist, an immigrant rights activist in Mexico, and I was able to see firsthand the conditions of violence that people is basically fleeing in, and the people is leaving their homelands. So it was really interesting to me to see first why people is really willing to cross Mexico, why people really wants to go to the United States. Mexico, as you may know, is one of the most dangerous places for undocumented migrants and also for refugees from all over the world. The situation in the country has exploited levels of violence that are unprecedented. And basically, having these thousands of people coming every year to Mexico willing to make it to the United States was really interesting to me. And that's why I decided to get more involved in all the work related to solidarity with Central America. And that's when I was able to realize the levels of violence and corruption that people is fleeing And basically, people is willing to risk their lives in order to save the ones of their children, in order to provide better future for their own families. I think it's really important to start also talking about that many of the people who's coming to the United States, many of the people who's crossing Mexico right now, many of the people who's now part of the caravan that we're seeing and that has caught public eye in recent days are not refugees. Now are not migrants. They are refugees now. It's important to talk about that we are not seeing a migration phenomena, but we are seeing a refugee phenomena in which people are fleeing to save their lives.
Eduardo Garcia is our guest. Eduardo, we have a lot to cover here in a limited amount of time, so I'm going to ask you a series of questions. One is, is this caravan bigger than last year or the earlier years? And if so, why?
Yeah. This caravan is almost formed by 7,000 people, more than 7,000 people. And this is way bigger. This is the biggest caravan we have seen crossing Mexico in order to come to the United States. But also we think that this caravan reflects the level of emergency that people is living in Central America. Many of these people, many of the people that are part of this caravan come from Honduras. And we cannot forget that after the U.S.-backed coup in 2009, Honduras became the most dangerous place in Central America. It actually had levels of violence higher than El Salvador, that used to be the most dangerous place in the entire hemisphere. So we can see how the conditions of violence people are fleeing are related to the United States intervention in the country. Basically, the United States has taken over the public services, and the United States is trying to take over the land, is trying to take over the resources. Private companies are basically killing people in order to take the land. And one of the most important cases, that, and we cannot forget it, is the Berta Cáceres case, in which the activist was killed by U.S. trained forces in 2016.
Yeah, López Obrador, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, will take office December 1st, a progressive new government in Mexico. Now, this caravan is taking place beforehand, and I just want to understand the political calculations, if there are political calculations, of the caravan organizers. There must be considerable infrastructure to support and sustain thousands of people traveling. People have to be fed, and they have to, there are motor vehicles that come with them. There's obviously issues of repression or the threat of repression. And the government in Mexico, the current Mexican government, not progressive. What's the status of that? And do the caravan organizers know how this is playing out in terms of American politics, where the Republican Party is demagogically, and Trump himself demagogically, using the caravan as if it's a threat to the American people and to the United States, as if there's going to be an invasion from the horde coming north from the south? Do the caravan organizers know about that part of it? And in terms of their own strategy and their own calculations, if there are some, if there's not, that's, we want to know that too. But how do they process that?
Oh, I think this is an amazing question, because something I would like to clarify is that there are no organizers of this caravan. Basically, this caravan started as something organic, and it started by the own people. Basically, people start getting together in San Pedro Sula, in Tegucigalpa, and they were like, you know, the conditions we're living in are like horrible, so we have to leave. So basically, people by themselves start organizing, and they were like passing or spreading the word from word of mouth, and basically they got together, and that's how they start fleeing, and that's how they left Honduras. There has been journalists or activists that have been accompanying them and basically giving some advice. However, there are no coordinators of the caravan. There is no one group. There is no one person that is leading this stuff. It's basically the willing of the masses that is taking over the caravan. And basically, it's really interesting to see how possible or as possible it can be, people is trying to have consensus and to have like a democratic model in the way in which they cross Mexico. You know, something that was really important to see was that while people was crossing into Mexico from Guatemala, the main demand of the entire caravan was like, we have to cross together. We're not going to allow anybody of us to stay, and we're not going to allow any authority to take one of us. So just wanted to mention that. And on the other hand, I think it's really interesting to listen what Donald Trump has said, because even when they're playing this game in which they're using the caravan to increase the support of Republican activists or Republican people in the United States, it's really important for us to mention that the situation of the caravan, what we are seeing nowadays is that the situation in Honduras goes beyond elections. And it's a pity that now the United States government, that Donald Trump's administration, is basically blackmailing Central American governments about, like, you know, like taking resources because they weren't able to stop migrants from coming to the United States. And it's something that is really important to say, is that in the face of the violence that has led to the mass exodus of thousands and thousands of Hondurans, organizations in the United States and even organizations in Honduras have demanded to the United States government to end military and security aid to Juan Orlando's regime. However, we are demanding the United States to stop funding, not as a blackmail tool used by Donald Trump, but as a way to guarantee the protection of the human rights of the Honduran people.
Eduardo, let me just jump in because we have 2 minutes left. To those who say in the United States that while the caravan is organic, that it's the people coming out, desperate people fleeing persecution, fleeing oppression, fleeing repression, in other words, spontaneously developing, as you said, some people have made the assertion that there is also a manipulation either by the Honduran government or right-wing forces in Mexico or the Trump administration to allow this to go forward because the optics are actually beneficial to the Republican Party demagogic racist campaign. To that assertion, what do you say?
I would like to say that this movement is not going to stop. It's not going to be stopped by anybody. And it's a pity that the Republican Party is using it to get votes, because actually the conditions were created by the same United States government. And we can see how all the assumptions made by Donald Trump are not other than fallacies, and basically all of them are lies. In this caravan, we have heard people of the Republican Party saying that there are terrorists coming with this caravan, that there are guerrilla people, that there are gang members coming in this caravan. This caravan is mainly formed by women, by children fleeing violence. And it's important to mention that the gangs that the Republican Party is saying are inviting the United States, the gangs were created by the United States government, were created within the United States. And the gangs crisis and the gang situations we're seeing in Central America were created by the United States, by the United States government, because of all the interventionist policies they have had starting back in the 70s. So we can say that those are lies. And this movement is not going to be stopped if there is no structural changes in Central America. Juan Orlando's government is basically using this to repress its own people and to repress all the activists that have been willing to put some light on the issues that Honduras are living in.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. We want to thank Eduardo Garcia. Eduardo joined us from Tucson, Arizona. He's an activist. He's a photojournalist. He was born in Mexico City. He's a coordinator for the Alliance for Global Justice's Prison Imperialism Project, and he supports the solidarity work of people in Honduras. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. Cyber Command is targeting individual Russian operatives to try to deter them from influencing the U.S. midterm elections, telling them that American operatives have identified them and are tracking their work. But a 2011 investigation by the Guardian newspaper found that the U.S. military was developing software that would allow it to secretly manipulate social media sites by using fake online personas to influence internet conversations and to spread pro-American propaganda. Sound familiar? We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you again.
Alexander, does this sound familiar? I mean, we talk about Russia all the time, and what we don't talk about is how many elections the U.S. has tried to influence since the 1947 Italian elections, which have gone down in history as the first election targeted and influenced by the Central Intelligence Agency.
And it's based on this new story, you'd think, like, wait, did the United States create the strategy of false online personas and
Imagine.
Bots churning stuff out? I don't know.
Well, to answer your first question, it is depressingly familiar. I mean, blaming Russia for election setbacks has now become the default position, not just in the United States, but across the entire Western world, it would seem. So, I mean, if a referendum doesn't work out in Macedonia or a right-wing party does well in Bavaria or something like that happens, of course it's the Russians' fault and always the fingers are pointed. But I'm glad you brought up the story of U.S. election interference in elections because, of course, it has happened on a simply enormous scale. And in many countries, I mean, starting in Italy, but Greece, of course, which is the country that I was, where I was born and of which I'm still a citizen, as well as being a British citizen, by the way, American election interference in Greece, as I very well remember, was extremely open, and of course, especially so in the 1960s, when a party that won an election, which the United States didn't like, provoked a military coup, which the United States backed. So for the United States to talk in this way, to point all the time at fingers at Russia, to say that it doesn't do these things, is very strange to those who know American history. And, of course, American history going all the way back to the 1940s. Now, saying all of that, I don't want to suggest it's only the United States that does this thing. But there is nothing new or original about it. And as, of course, for these cyber campaigns that we're hearing about, anybody who uses the internet at all, who goes onto the internet regularly, will see that the place is full of trolls of every conceivable description, many of them undoubtedly backed by all kinds of governments and political entities, that there's constant attempts to manipulate and control the way information and ideas pass and to influence elections. I remember how an uprising in Moldova, for example, was orchestrated through Twitter with many people at the time. This is in, I think, about 2009, saying it was done with the involvement of Western intelligence agencies. So let us not talk about this thing all the time as if it is so extraordinary and so unique and attach always the name of Russia to it.
John, I want to read some of this article from The Guardian in 2011.
Yes, this is a good piece.
2011, March 17th, 2011, 2 days before the anniversary, what would have been the eighth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq based on lies. But here's the headline. Again, I really think this is so important to go back in history because this is 2011. Revealed, U.S. spy operation that manipulates social media. Subtitle, military sock pocket software creates fake online identities to spread pro-American propaganda. Now, this is March 17th, 2011. The U.S. military, and it's under a picture of David Petraeus. And Petraeus says, General Petraeus has previously said U.S. online psychological operations are aimed at, quote, countering extremist ideology and propaganda, close quote. The U.S. military is developing software that will let it secretly manipulate social media sites by using fake online personas to influence internet conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. A California corporation has been awarded a contract with the United States Central Command, that's CENTCOM, which oversees U.S. armed operations in the Middle East and Central Asia to develop what is described as, quote, an online persona management service, close quote, that will allow one U.S. serviceman or woman to control up to 10 separate identities based all over the world. Okay, that's 8 years ago. We knew that this was an operation from the Pentagon. Now, American media, Washington Post, CNN, the Russians have developed sock pockets and fake false personas. I mean, I really think, truthfully, that the U.S. was the pioneer. We don't know yet to the extent that the Russians or some Russian entity did this in 2016. We don't know what. We're still kind of waiting for real evidence.
Right.
But nonetheless, this is an absolute, absolute admission that the U.S. was doing this 6 years before or 5 years before the 2016 election. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, the United States is the first country where the internet really took off. And it is completely understandable, given the previous history that you discussed about the United States interfering in elections all the way back in 1947. And of course, anybody else who's been familiar with the history knows about massive U.S. influence campaigns that happened in many countries during the Cold War. It would not be at all surprising if it was the United States that was the pioneer in doing this thing, and if the United States did this on a huge scale, and I'm sure it does. And can I just say something about the Russian campaign during the 2016 election? Now, I mean, I'm not an expert in these things, but I mean, I have completely failed to understand why so much weight is attached to this alleged campaign. It seems to have been enormously incoherent. The link to the Russian government was never fully and clearly established, not even in Special Counsel Mueller's famous indictment. And I mean, it was so muddled and confused that it's barely conceivable, it seems to me, that it had any real influence on effect on the U.S. election that year. Why are we wasting so much time on it? I just don't understand.
Alexander Mercuris is our guest. Alexander, it's not just Alexander, John. Alexander has dogs. And our audience knows that Alexander has dogs because they faithfully bark. They're at your side, Alexander.
Well, indeed, sir. They're off chasing these mysterious bots that are causing all this trouble.
Excellent. You have a little army there. I want to go back, John, real quick. I want to read a little bit more from this 2011 Guardian article. Again, 2011.
It was really prescient. When I read it this morning, I was stunned by it and by how current it is.
Yeah. And how Americans don't know this.
Yes.
Central Command contract stipulates that each fake online persona must have a convincing background, history, and supporting details, and that up to 50 U.S.-based controllers should be able to operate false identities from their workstations, quote, without fear of being discovered by sophisticated adversaries, close quote. Central Command spokesman Commander Bill Speaks said, quote, the technology supports classified blogging activities, that's a euphemism, also known as fake personas, on foreign language websites to enable Central Command to counter violent extremist and enemy propaganda outside the United States. Of course, it's for a noble cause, fighting extremism. I mean, it's such an admission. This is America. Everybody who's listening to the show, this was an American cyber offensive operation designed to trick people on Facebook and other social media platforms. That's exactly what this was. We have about a minute and a half left, Alexander. Go ahead.
Yes, and can I just say, I also remember reading some years ago an article, I believe it was in The Guardian, which confirmed that Britain and GCHQ and the British intelligence agencies are involved doing exactly the same thing. So here we have the United States sending out threats via social media to people who it alleges are involved in some sort of Russian campaign, which is exactly the same as the kind of campaign the United States does itself, and does itself on an enormous scale. And of course, the United States has been consistently trying to control the social media landscape. And I have to say something else quickly, which is that it does worry me that the United States has been ramping all this up in the way that it is at the moment, in part precisely so that it can control the social media landscape more easily by accusing people, voices on social media that he doesn't like of being Russian bots. So we have the United States criticizing others for doing what he does itself, and at the same time, as I said, trying to increase, ramp up its own control of the media space, partly so that it can promote its own message.
Both things are true, John. It's both. It shows the U.S. is doing it, perhaps pioneering, and yes, at the same time using this same sort of reasoning to shut down alternative media.
Indeed. Well, we were very pleased to be joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. Alexander's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Chinese President Xi Jinping yesterday opened the world's longest bridge 9 years after construction began. The 34-mile-long span will connect Hong Kong and Macau to the Chinese mainland and is supposed to enhance economic growth in the region. But the BBC and other British media are treating the bridge like an act of aggression. We're joined from London by John Ross, senior fellow at Chongyang Institute, Renmin University of China, and an award-winning resident columnist with several Chinese media organizations. John, welcome back.
Hello, how do you do?
John, can you start off by telling us a little bit about this bridge and why it's connecting now Hong Kong and Macau to the mainland? What was the purpose?
Well, the key thing is you've got to understand this is a bridge which connects a region of more than 40 million people. And Hong Kong and Macau have very high per capita GDP. And you have tens of millions of people in the Pearl Delta region. So what they're attempting to do, therefore, is create a very large complex in which the advantages of Hong Kong and Macau, particularly Hong Kong, because Macau's a specialist in gambling, really, but Hong Kong has got very advanced service industries, will interact with the still cheaper labor costs in the Pearl Region Delta. And that will it will give the advantage to Hong Kong that it has a further access to the mainland for relatively cheap labor. And it will give the advantage to the Pearl Delta that it's got the high per capita GDP of Hong Kong and Macau. So it's a question of bringing up the whole region. But I mean, you have to understand this region's bigger than most European countries. So this bridge is therefore the center of an enormous economic complex.
I was listening to the BBC World Service report, John Ross, this morning when I was driving into work. And I was really taken by the fact that the BBC hosts were treating the construction of this bridge, the biggest bridge in the world, linking Hong Kong with mainland China, as if it was, as we said in the beginning, an act of aggression, because they were saying this shows how Hong Kong, which is semi-autonomous or independent, has a democratic assembly, is being kind of reeled in by this dominant power, mainland China, as if Hong Kong wasn't part of China. And here you have a British media outlet. I mean, here you have, let's help the audience. How did Hong Kong be separated from China by Britain? And then the sort of catastrophizing of the bridge by the BBC as if it's the end of freedom now in Hong Kong.
Well, but this is just 150 years of hypocrisy, which is well understood in China. The single biggest thing I've ever written in China, which was a Weibo, which is a Chinese post, equivalent to Twitter post, which was read by 73 million people, which is big even by Chinese standards, said the British attitude to Hong Kong is total hypocrisy. They say that you have an indirect method of electing the governor of Hong Kong, but during the entire time that Britain ruled Hong Kong, it never allowed the election of the governor in any form whatever. You know, this is one of the most sickening aspects of British hypocrisy and is generally recognized in Hong Kong. I mean, I have some presence on Chinese social media. I've got 950,000 followers on Weibo. And they understand that the whole attitude of Britain towards Hong Kong is one of the most nauseous things. It was conquered because Britain wanted the right to export opium to China, and it was held onto with no democratic rights whatever for 150 years. And the situation is now more democratic than it's been. So this is just an example of things. And frankly, the main thing it does in people in China is it shows up how hypocritical Britain's attitude is and how the BBC is really just a propaganda arm of the British government. So it has no credibility, whatever.
Not to get too far off the subject, but I've said the same exact thing about the BBC for the last 30 years. It's as though whatever the conventional wisdom is, the BBC takes the opposite tack. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes they look foolish. And in a case like this, where they're just embracing colonialism and imperialism for the sake of being different or contrarian, they look foolish.
I don't think that it's contrarian. They consider their job is to report the views of the British government. I mean, the famous thing in 1926, when there was the general strike, Rees, who was the head of the BBC, said, his job was to support the government. And that's what it's done. It's just a joke. They're not objective in the slightest. If you regard them as a sort of, British equivalent to the output of North Korea or something, then you will get a fairly accurate view of the views of the BBC. The difference is in China, because obviously the question of Hong Kong is one of the most sordid questions in the whole of Chinese history. Because can you imagine that Britain launched a war in order to force China to import opium? I mean, it's disgusting.
And to finance the British colonial project in India. And the Chinese resisted, and the Brits invaded, and the punishment was the seizure of Hong Kong, 1842.
Yeah, but can you imagine to attack a country in order to force it to import opium, right? So therefore, obviously, the question of the history of Hong Kong is known to every person in China. So therefore, frankly, the British, all that the BBC does is makes itself look more than usually ridiculous with such a things. And obviously, this bridge, it's to create a huge, big complex, economic development. This is going to, it's not a bridge designed to, produce its big result during the next 6 months or something. It's a strategic concept to knit together this whole part of southern China. And as I say, only Britain, France, and Germany, if my memory is right, would actually have bigger Italy as well, would have bigger populations. This is this whole region would be a rather medium-sized country in world terms.
Indeed. John Ross is our guest. At midnight on July 1st, 1997, the Crown Colony of Hong Kong finally and officially reverted to Chinese sovereignty. So here we are, 31 years later, a bridge, the largest, longest bridge in the world connecting Hong Kong to the mainland. Aside from the fact that it's getting like boos and catcalls from the British media and from the Western media, let's just talk about the prospects for economic development in China right now and as a consequence of projects like this.
Well, the fundamental thing is that China's growing more than twice the rate of the United States. I mean, the most fundamental thing that China's done is it's responsible for 73% of the reduction in the number of people living in poverty in the world. This is an unbelievable statistic. It means China has lifted more people out of poverty than the whole population of the European Union or the whole continent of Latin America. And Britain spends its time going on about, things about building bridges, etc. It's completely absurd. I mean, it's one of the good things to be in China is you see how ridiculous the British perspective of things, or the BBC perspective of things, Britain is not the question, the BBC perspective is, because instead of the whole of the world celebrating the fact that China has made this gigantic economic progress, this is the fastest economic development in human history in any major country, and lifted the largest number of people out of poverty in the world in human history. Not everything is perfect in China, and the Chinese people are well aware of that. Instead of saying, oh, this is absolutely fantastically good, and we have doubtless there are many things to be improved, and for example, there had been a serious problem with pollution, which is now being tackled. Instead of saying this is fantastically good and how can it be improved, the BBC spends its time trying to knock down, saying nothing good is going on, et cetera, et cetera. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's so true, John. It's the And I think I want to remind our audience, it's the function of demonization. Those numbers that John Ross stated, you know, if you have an objective capability and an objective faculty, if you're not part of a witch hunt, if you're not part of the propaganda arm of the Pentagon, which is now targeting China and Russia for major power conflict, if you're not part of that and you just think for yourself or look at those numbers, the rise of or the bringing out of poverty of this many people, hundreds of millions of people in about 30 years, and the continued economic integration of the country and the region, you would think, well, these are good things, but we are being taught because of demonization, again, as part of a U.S. foreign policy objective, always demonize the next adversary. Instead of people saying, yeah, China's got contradictions, it has a lot of contradictions, it has a lot of problems, but it's also made progress. I mean, real palpable progress for human beings. Why not emphasize that or at least recognize that instead of just treating China as the demon?
Right.
And that's what's going on. 30 seconds left, John Ross. How do you want to end it?
Well, simply that's the key thing. You know, China's got a lot of problems. It's still got to get itself to be a high-income economy by world standards. That's going to take about another 5 or 6 years. As I live in Beijing, I can tell you that there was a serious problem of pollution there, although now it's been overtaken in pollution by India. And that's what people should say. They should say, no one's claiming China is absolutely perfect. That's ridiculous. But its effect of economic growth and its effect of lifting people out of poverty is a sensational contribution to the whole of humanity.
Absolutely right. That was the voice of John Ross, who joined us from London. John is senior fellow at Chungnyang Institute, Renmin University of China, and he's an award-winning resident columnist with several different Chinese media organizations. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. We are 14 short days away from midterm elections, and in many states, early voting is already breaking records. Most of those states are in the South, where early voting is up from between 100 to 1,000%. And according to the Cook Political Report, it's Republicans who seem to be flocking to the polls. I'm joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here. It's some pretty interesting stuff going on, really dramatic, like sort of late stage developments. What do you make about those early voting totals? What do you think motivating it?
MSNBC had a feature story about this morning saying that this could mean that there won't be a blue wave. It's incredible. The numbers are incredible. They're breaking records. All of that or none of that may be true. What is true is that it's mostly Republicans who vote early every election cycle. There are a lot of states in which you can vote early. Most of those states happen to be in the South. Republicans usually go to the polls more consistently, more regularly than Democrats do. So I think that we're not seeing the huge changes that the mainstream media wants us to believe we're seeing. I think that people are energized, certainly. I think that people are excited about some of these races. Donald Trump is going around the country. He's traveling everywhere, it seems, going around the country telling people that this actually is a referendum on him and on his presidency. And he urged voters in Montana just yesterday or the day before to consider this to be a vote for him when they go into the polling place and vote for their local Republican. So I think that it's not as big of a deal as the media wants us to believe. And the bottom line, I think, is voting is good. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. Get out there and vote.
And this has become a particularly huge question in Georgia, right? Because there's this situation where so on the Democratic side, there's Stacey Abrams, who's a black woman running in one of the, you know, deep South states, former Jim Crow states, versus Kemp, who is actually the Secretary of State of Georgia, which means that he's, you know, theoretically he's in charge of facilitating people's votes, but something much different is happening in Georgia, right?
Oh, there are active efforts underway to suppress the vote in Georgia. In fact, Rolling Stone published a story today that I think is alarming. They have obtained an audio recording of Brian Kemp, the Georgia Secretary of State running for governor as a Republican, saying that he's concerned about the Democrats' voter turnout operation. He says, quote, "Their operation continues to concern us, especially if everybody uses and exercises their right to vote." So he's worried that people are going to exercise their constitutional right to vote. What he's doing then as Secretary of State, and he's refused to resign that position as Secretary of State while he runs for governor, so he's overseeing his own election. What he's done is that he has thrown 110,000 people off the voter rolls because they've missed two elections in a row. And he is actively suppressing another 30,000 votes because it's called the exact match scandal, where if your name has a misspelling in it, he's ordered poll workers to turn you away, that you're not allowed to vote if your name has a misspelling. So, you know, if your internal policy in your campaign is to suppress the vote because you're worried about your opponent's supporters' turnout, and you're the Secretary of State, so you can control that kind of thing, I think it's a very dangerous combination.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, what would be motivating higher turnout in states like Georgia that have these competitive races? What's the enthusiasm coming from for the Democratic base?
Well, more than any other state, with the exception maybe of Virginia, Georgia is turning purple. Virginia has become pretty much a blue state because there are so many people living in Northern Virginia who vote Democrat that it essentially carries the rest of the state, which continues to be Republican except for the Norfolk, Virginia Beach area. But Georgia really is turning purple. Atlanta and the Atlanta suburbs tend to be Democratic. Those blue areas are pushing farther and farther away from the city. And so where rural Georgia is still solidly Republican, they're getting to the point where there may be enough votes in the greater Atlanta area to turn the state Democratic. Now, there's an African-American woman, Stacey Abrams, a state senator from Georgia, who is running for governor. The latest polls have her either tied with Brian Kemp or slightly ahead of Brian Kemp. And so that's why there's so much interest in this race in Georgia. Otherwise, you know, I can't help but to think that people wouldn't really care if there was a voter suppression program out there. Certainly there's a voter suppression scheme in Kansas, and because that's a solidly Republican state, nobody really is talking about it.
Right. So that you're referring to, is that Chris Kobach?
It's Chris Kobach. He's also the Secretary of State of Kansas and is running for governor. It's exactly the same situation that we're seeing in Georgia. So he's overseeing his own election. He refuses to resign as Secretary of State, and he too is actively suppressing what would be Democratic votes.
Yeah, and Chris Kobach, an anti-immigrant zealot. I think he was on the short list for not Attorney General, but the head of the Department of Homeland Security.
That's right. And it was Chris Kobach who served on this ad hoc panel appointed by the president at the very, very beginning of his presidency, in which he said that there were 2 million votes cast by illegal immigrants and then couldn't produce evidence of a single one. The only people who voted illegally, as it turned out, were a woman in Iowa who voted for Trump twice because she said she wanted to offset the illegal immigrants' votes for Hillary Clinton. She was convicted and sentenced to probation. And an African-American woman who had served time in prison and wrongly believed that she was registered to vote. There was no criminal intent, but she went and cast a provisional ballot that wasn't even counted. And now she's going back to prison for a number of years.
Wow. Well, so there's that huge, subplot to the election, right? You know, people trying to exercise their right to vote, which is a hard, hard fought right in the United States, and not that long ago was won for big, big sections of the population. Let's talk about some of the other races that are going on across the country. I mean, in Texas, it's shockingly actually close. I mean, you were mentioning some of the, you know, Donald Trump making this election all about himself and having these big rallies different places. One of those was in Texas,
right.
Which is kind of surprising they asked to spend time there.
For Lion Ted Cruz,
yeah.
who he's now calling Beautiful Ted Cruz.
Oh, is that the name?
Yeah, so the president went to campaign for Beautiful Ted Cruz, and this is after saying that Cruz's father was involved in the John F. Kennedy assassination, saying that Cruz wasn't really an American because he was born in Canada to an American mother. Yeah, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump hate each other's guts. Cruz refused to endorse Trump even at the Republican convention, even after he was given a primetime speaking slot.
And I think he was booed as it became apparent, right, that he wasn't actually going to do it.
He was actually booed on stage because he refused to endorse Donald Trump. And Ted Cruz is in trouble against Beto O'Rourke, who's a liberal Democratic congressman who has visited literally every single county in the state of Texas. There are more than 250 counties. I think it's something like 256. And O'Rourke has made no secret of his progressive views on a whole host of issues. For a while, they were tied, or as close to tied as you can possibly get within the margin of error. O'Rourke has vastly outraised Ted Cruz, but Cruz is now ahead in most of the recent polls by between 6 and 9 percentage points.
Yeah, well, we've just got about 2 minutes left. I'm looking at some of the most recent opinion polls that came out. There are a few that were released about the Senate race in Florida. Two of them have Nelson up by pretty substantial margin, 6% for a Quinnipiac poll and Bay News, so a local poll that shows Nelson up by 8%. There's another local poll, though, that shows Rick Scott up by 1 point. So, I mean, it seems like that could still go either way. What do you expect?
I got a fundraising email this morning from Senator Nelson saying that he's behind. I don't know if his internal polls have him behind, but the pundits seem to think this is going to be one of the closest races in the country. Governor Scott, who's running for the Senate as a Republican, has unlimited funds. He's a, you know, 100 millionaire. He spends his own money. Nelson is not a millionaire. He has to raise his money. It's going to be very, very close. I think, though, because it's an off-cycle election, that Nelson's going to pull this one out.
Yeah, and there's also a very close governor's race there. There was another Quinnipiac poll that was just released today that shows Gillum, their Democratic candidate, up by 6 points over Ron DeSantis, who's very closely tied to Donald Trump.
Yeah, Ron DeSantis is a Republican congressman from Florida. He has surrounded himself with people who can really accurately be described as racists or white supremacists. And he's made the mistake of putting his foot in his mouth a number of times on race issues during the course of this campaign. The president's support notwithstanding, this really was DeSantis's race to lose. Gillum was a relative unknown. He upset a better-funded Democrat in the Democratic primary. But still, DeSantis is such a flawed candidate. I think Gillum wins this race and becomes the first black governor of Florida. I think we're going to have to leave it there, too. I wish I could sit here and talk about politics all day. But anyway, you've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.